replied Mr. Jawkins in an impatient manner. "I assure you there's an objection, Mr. Copperfield. Hopeless. What you wish to be done can't be done. I really have got an appointment at the bank." With that, he fairly ran away. And to the best of my knowledge, it was 3 days before he showed himself in the Commons again. Being very anxious to leave no stone unturned, I waited until Mr. Spenlow came in, and then described what had passed, giving him to understand that I was not hopeless of his being able to soften the adamantine Jawkins if he would undertake that task. "Copperfield," returned Mr. Spenlow with a sagacious smile, "you have not known my partner, Mr. Jawkins, as long as I have. Nothing is farther from my thoughts than to attribute any degree of artifice to Mr. Jawkins. But Mr. Jawkins has a way of stating his objections which often deceives people. No, Copperfield," shaking his head, "Mr. Jawkins is not to be moved, believe me." I was completely bewildered between Mr. Spenlow and Mr. Jawkins as to which of them really was the objecting partner. But I saw with sufficient clearness that there was obduracy somewhere in the firm, and that the recovery of my aunt's £1,000 was out of the question. In a state of despondency, which I remember with anything but satisfaction, for I know it still had too much reference to myself, though always in connection with Dora, I left the office and went homeward.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 16 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 17. David Copperfield, Cassette 17.
I was trying to familiarise my mind with the worst and to present to myself the arrangements we should have to make for the future in their sternest aspect, when a hackney chariot coming after me and stopping at my very feet occasioned me to look up. A fair hand was stretched forth to me from the window, and the face I had never seen without a feeling of serenity and happiness from the moment when it first turned back on the old oak staircase with the great broad balustrade, and when I associated its softened beauty with the stained glass window in the church, was smiling on me. "Agnes!" I joyfully exclaimed. "Oh, my dear Agnes! Of all people in the world, what a pleasure to see you!" "Is it indeed?" she said in her cordial voice. "I want to talk to you so much," said I. "It's such a lightening of my heart only to look at you. If I had had a conjurer's cap, there's no one I should have wished for but you."
"What?"
returned Agnes. "Well, perhaps Dora first," I admitted with a blush.
"Certainly Dora first, I hope,"
said Agnes, laughing.
"But you next," said I.
"Where are you going?" She was going to my rooms to see my aunt. The day being very fine, she was glad to come out of the chariot, which smelt, I had my head in it all this time, like a stable put under a cucumber frame. I dismissed the coachman, and she took my arm, and we walked on together. She was like hope embodied to me. How different I felt in one short minute, having Agnes at my side. My aunt had written her one of the odd, abrupt notes, very little longer than a banknote, to which her epistolary efforts were usually limited. She'd stated therein that she had fallen into adversity and was leaving Dover for good, but had quite made up her mind to it and was so well that nobody need be uncomfortable about her. Agnes had come to London to see my aunt, between whom and herself there'd been a mutual liking these many years. Indeed, it dated from the time of my taking up my residence in Mr. Wickfield's house. She was not alone, she said. Her papa was with her, and Uriah Heep. "And now they're partners," said I. "Confound him!"
"Yes," said Agnes.
"They have some business here, and I took advantage of their coming to come too. You mustn't think my visit all friendly and disinterested, Trotwood, for I'm afraid I may be cruelly prejudiced. I do not like to let Papa go away alone with him."
"Does he exercise the same influence over Mr. Wickfield still, Agnes?"
Agnes shook her head. "There's such a change at home," said she, "that you would scarcely know the dear old house. They live with us now." "They?" said I. "Mr. Heap and his mother. He sleeps in your old room," said Agnes, looking up into my face. "I wish I had the ordering of his dreams," said I. "He wouldn't sleep there long." "I keep my own little room," said Agnes, "where I used to learn my lessons. How the time goes, you remember? The little panelled room that opens from the drawing room." "Remember, Agnes? When I saw you for the first time coming out at the door with your quaint little basket of keys hanging at your side." "It's just the same," said Agnes, smiling. "I'm glad you think of it so pleasantly. We were very happy." "We were indeed," said I. "I keep that room to myself still, but I cannot always desert Mrs. Heap, you know. And so," said Agnes quietly, "I feel obliged to bear her company when I might prefer to be alone. But I have no other reason to complain of her. If she tires me sometimes by her praises of her son, it's only natural in a mother. He is a very good son to her." I looked at Agnes when she said these words, without detecting in her any consciousness of Uriah's design. Her mild but earnest eyes met mine with their own beautiful frankness, and there was no change in her gentle face. "The chief evil of their presence in the house," said Agnes, "is that I cannot be as near Papa as I could wish, Uriah Heep being so much between us, and cannot watch over him, if that's not too bold a thing to say, as closely as I would. But if any fraud or treachery is practising against him, I hope that simple love and truth will be stronger in the end. I hope that real love and truth are stronger in the end than any evil or misfortune in the world." A certain bright smile, which I never saw on any other face, died away, even while I thought how good it was, and how familiar it had once been to me. And she asked me, with a quick change of expression — we were drawing very near my street — if I knew how the reverse in my aunt's circumstances had been brought about. On my replying no, she hadn't told me yet, Agnes became thoughtful, and I fancied I felt her arm tremble in mine. We found my aunt alone, in a state of some excitement. A difference of opinion had arisen between herself and Mrs. Crupp on an abstract question: the propriety of chambers being inhabited by the gentler sex. And my aunt, utterly indifferent to spasms on the part of Mrs. Crupp, had cut the dispute short by informing that lady that she smelt of my brandy, and that she would trouble her to walk out. Both of these expressions Mrs. Crupp considered actionable, and had expressed her intention of bringing before a British jury, meaning it was supposed the bulwark of our national liberties. My aunt, however, having had time to cool while Peggotty was out showing Mr. Dick the soldiers at the Horse Guards, and being, besides, greatly pleased to see Agnes, rather plumed herself on the affair than otherwise, and received us with unimpaired good humour. When Agnes laid her bonnet on the table and sat down beside her, I couldn't but think, looking on her mild eyes and her radiant forehead, how natural it seemed to have her there, how trustfully, although she was so young and inexperienced, my aunt confided in her, how strong she was indeed in simple love and truth. We began to talk about my aunt's losses, and I told them what I'd tried to do that morning. "Which was injudicious, Trot," said my aunt, "but well meant. You're a generous boy. I suppose I must say young man now. And I'm proud of you, my dear. So far, so good. Now, Trot and Agnes, let us look the case of Betsy Trotwood in the face and see how it stands." I observed Agnes turn pale as she looked very attentively at my aunt. My aunt, patting her cat, looked very attentively at Agnes. "Betsy Trotwood," said my aunt, who had always kept her money matters to herself, I don't mean your sister, Trot, my dear, but myself. Had a certain property. It don't matter how much. Enough to live on. More, for she'd saved a little and added to it. Betsy funded her property for some time, and then, by the advice of her man of business, laid it out on landed security. That did very well, and returned very good interest, till Betsy was paid off. I'm talking of Betsy as if she was a man of war. Well, then, Betsy had to look about her for a new investment. She thought she was wiser now than her man of business, who was not such a good man of business by this time as he used to be. I am alluding to your father, Agnes. And she took it into her head to lay it out for herself. So she took her pigs, said my aunt, to a foreign market. And a very bad market it turned out to be. First, she lost in the mining way, and then she lost in the diving way, fishing up treasure or some such tom-tiddler nonsense, explained my aunt, rubbing her nose, and then she lost in the mining way again, and last of all, to set the thing entirely to rights, she lost in the banking way. I don't know what the bank shares were worth for a little while, said my aunt. Cent per cent was the lowest of it, I believe. But the bank was at the other end of the world and tumbled into space, for what I know. Anyhow, it fell to pieces and never will and never can pay sixpence. And Betsy's sixpences were all there, and there's an end of them. Least said, soonest mended. My aunt concluded this philosophical summary by fixing her eyes with a kind of triumph on Agnes, whose colour was gradually returning. "Dear Miss Trotwood, is that all the history?" said Agnes. "I hope it's enough, child," said my aunt. "If there'd been more money to lose, it wouldn't have been all, I dare say. Betsy would have contrived to throw that after the rest and make another chapter, I have little doubt. But there was no more money, and there's no more story." Agnes had listened at first with suspended breath. Her colour still came and went, but she breathed more freely. I thought I knew why. I thought she'd had some fear that her unhappy father might be in some way to blame for what had happened. My aunt took her hand in hers and laughed. "Is that all?" repeated my aunt. "Well, yes, that's all, except..." And she lived happy ever afterwards. Perhaps I may add that of Betsy yet one of these days. Now, Agnes, you have a wise head, so have you, Trot, in some things, though I can't compliment you always. And here my aunt shook her own at me with an energy peculiar to herself. What's to be done? Here's the cottage, taking one time with another, will produce, say, £70 a year. I think we may safely put it down at that. Well, that's all we've got, said my aunt, with whom it was an idiosyncrasy, as it is with some horses, to stop very short when she appeared to be in a fair way of going on for a long while. Then, said my aunt after a rest, there's Dick. He's good for 100 a year, but of course that must be expended on himself. I would sooner send him away, though I know I'm the only person who appreciates him, than have him and not spend his money on himself. How can Trot and I do best upon our means? What do you say, Agnes? I say, aunt, I interposed, that I must do something. Go for a soldier, do you mean? Returned my aunt, alarmed. Or go to sea. I won't hear of it. You are to be a proctor. We're not going to have any knockings on the head in this family, if you please, sir. I was about to explain that I wasn't desirous of introducing that mode of provision into the family, when Agnes inquired if my rooms were held for any long term. You come to the point, my dear, said my aunt. They are not to be got rid of for 6 months at least, unless they could be underlet. That I don't believe. The last man died here. Five people out of six would die, of course, of that woman in Nankeen with the flannel petticoat. I have a little ready money. And I agree with you, the best thing we can do is to live the term out here and get Dick a bedroom hard by. I thought it my duty to hint at the discomfort my aunt would sustain from living in a continual state of guerrilla warfare with Mrs. Crupp. but she disposed of that objection summarily by declaring that on the first demonstration of hostilities she was prepared to astonish Mrs. Crupp for the whole remainder of her natural life. "I've been thinking, Trotwood," said Agnes diffidently, "that if you had time..." "I have a good deal of time, Agnes. I'm always disengaged after 4 or 5 o'clock, and I have time early in the morning." "In one way and another," said I, conscious of reddening a little as I thought of the hours and hours I had devoted to fagging about town and to and fro upon the Norwood Road, "I have abundance of time." "I know you wouldn't mind," said Agnes, coming to me and speaking in a low voice, so full of sweet and hopeful consideration that I hear it now, "the duties of a secretary." "Mind, my dear Agnes?" "Because," continued Agnes, "Dr. Strong has acted on his intention of retiring and has come to live in London, and he asked Papa, I know, if he could recommend him one. Don't you think he would rather have his favourite old pupil near him than anybody else?" "Dear Agnes," said I, "what should I do without you? You are always my good angel. I told you so before. I never think of you in any other light." Agnes answered with her pleasant laugh that one good angel, meaning Dora, was enough, and went on to remind me that the doctor had been used to occupy himself in his study early in the morning and in the evening, and that probably my leisure would suit his requirements very well. I was scarcely more delighted with the prospect of earning my own bread than with the hope of earning it under my old master. In short, acting on the advice of Agnes, I sat down and wrote a letter to the doctor stating my object and appointing to call on him next day at 10 in the forenoon. This I addressed to Highgate, for in that place so memorable to me he lived, and went out and posted myself without losing a minute. Wherever Agnes was, some agreeable token of her noiseless presence seemed inseparable from the place. When I came back, I found my aunt's birds hanging, just as they'd hung so long in the parlour window of the cottage, and my easy chair imitating my aunt's much easier chair in its position at the open window, and even the round green fan which my aunt had brought away with her screwed under the windowsill. I knew it'd done all this by its seeming to have quietly done itself. And I should have known in a moment who had arranged my neglected books in the old order of my school days, even if I'd supposed Agnes to be miles away instead of seeing her busy with them and smiling at the disorder into which they'd fallen. My aunt was quite gracious on the subject of the Thames. It really did look very well with the sun upon it, though not like the sea before the cottage. But she could not relent towards the London smoke, which she said peppered everything. A complete revolution, in which Peggotty bore a prominent part, was being effected in every corner of my rooms in regard of this pepper, and I was looking on, thinking how little even Peggotty seemed to do with a good deal of bustle, and how much Agnes did without any bustle at all, when a knock came at the door. "I think," said Agnes, turning pale, "it's Papa. He promised me that he'd come." I opened the door and admitted not only Mr. Wickfield, but Uriah Heep. I'd not seen Mr. Wickfield for some time. I was prepared for a great change in him after what I'd heard from Agnes, but his appearance shocked me. It was not that he looked many years older, though still dressed with the old, scrupulous cleanliness, or that there was an unwholesome ruddiness upon his face, or that his eyes were full and bloodshot, or that there was a nervous trembling in his hand, the cause of which I knew and had for some years seen at work. It was not that he had lost his good looks, or his old bearing of a gentleman, for that he had not. But the thing that struck me most was that, with the evidences of his native superiority still upon him, he should submit himself to that crawling impersonation of meanness, Uriah Heep. The reversal of the two natures in their relative positions, Uriah's of power and Mr. Wickfield's of dependence, was a sight more painful to me than I can express. If I had seen an ape taking command of a man, I should hardly have thought it a more degrading spectacle. He appeared to be only too conscious of it himself. When he came in, he stood still, and with his head bowed as if he felt it. This was only for a moment, for Agnes softly said to him, "Papa, here is Miss Trotwood, and Trotwood whom you've not seen for a long while." And then he approached, and constrainedly gave my aunt his hand, and shook hands more cordially with me. In the moment's pause I speak of, I saw Uriah's countenance form itself into a most ill-favoured smile. Agnes saw it too, I think, for she shrank from him. What my aunt saw, or did not see, I defy the science of physiognomy to have made out without her own consent. I believe there never was anybody with such an imperturbable countenance when she chose. Her face might have been a dead wall on the occasion in question, for any light it threw upon her thoughts, until she broke silence with her usual abruptness. "Well, Wickfield," said my aunt, and he looked up at her for the first time, "I've been telling your daughter how well I've been disposing of my money for myself because I couldn't trust it to you, as you were growing rusty in business matters. We've been taking counsel together and getting on very well, all things considered. Agnes is worth the whole firm, in my opinion." "If I may humbly make the remark," said Uriah Heep with a writhe, "I fully agree with Miss Betsy Trotwood, and should be only too happy if Miss Agnes was a partner." "You're a partner yourself, you know," returned my aunt, "and that's about enough for you, I expect. How do you find yourself, sir?" In acknowledgement of this question, addressed to him with extraordinary curtness, Mr. Heap, uncomfortably clutching the blue bag he carried, replied that he was pretty well, he thanked my aunt, and hoped she was the same. "And you, Master, I should say Mr. Copperfield," pursued Uriah, "I hope I see you well. I'm rejoiced to see you, Mr. Copperfield, even under present circumstances." I believed that, for he seemed to relish them very much. "Present circumstances is not what your friends would wish for you, Mr. Copperfield. But it isn't money makes the man. I'm really unequal with my humble powers to express what it is," said Uriah, with a fawning jerk. "But it isn't money." Here he shook hands with me, not in a common way, but standing at a good distance from me, and lifting my hand up and down like a pump handle that he was a little afraid of. "And how do you think we are looking, Master Copperfield?" "I should say Mr.," fawned Uriah. "Don't you find Mr. Wickfield blooming, sir?" "Years don't tell much in our firm, Master Copperfield, except in raising up the humble, namely mother and self, and in developing," he added as an afterthought, "the beautiful, namely Miss Agnes." He jerked himself about after this compliment, in such an intolerable manner that my aunt, who had sat looking straight at him, lost all patience. "Deuce take the man," said my aunt sternly. "What's he about? Don't be galvanic, sir." "I ask your pardon, Miss Trotwood," returned Uriah. "I'm aware you're nervous." "Go along with you, sir," said my aunt, anything but appeased. "Don't presume to say so. I'm nothing of the sort. If you're an eel, sir, conduct yourself like one. If you're a man, control your limbs, sir." "Good God," said my aunt with great indignation, "I am not going to be serpentined and corkscrewed out of my senses." Mr. Heap was rather abashed, as most people might have been, by this explosion, which derived great additional force from the indignant manner in which my aunt afterwards moved in her chair and shook her head as if she were making snaps or bounces at him. But he said to me, aside, in a meek voice, "I am well aware, Master Copperfield, that Miss Trotwood, though an excellent lady, has a quick temper. Indeed, I think I had the pleasure of knowing her when I was a numble clerk before you did, Master Copperfield. and it's only natural, I'm sure, that it should be made quicker by present circumstances. The wonder is that it isn't much worse. I only called to say that if there was anything we could do in present circumstances, Mother or self or Wickfield and Heap, we should be really glad. I may go so far, said Uriah, with a sickly smile at his partner. Uriah Heap, said Mr. Wickfield in a monotonous, forced way, is active in the business, Trotwood. What he says I quite concur in. You know I had an old interest in you. Apart from that, what Uriah says I quite concur in. Ah, what a reward it is, said Uriah, drawing up one leg at the risk of bringing down upon himself another visitation from my aunt, to be so trusted in. But I hope I'm able to do something to relieve him from the fatigues of business, Master Copperfield.
Uriah Heep is a great relief to me, said Mr. Wickfield in the same dull voice. It's a load off my mind, Trotwood, to have such a partner.
The Red Fox made him say all this, I knew, to exhibit him to me in the light he had indicated on the night when he poisoned my rest. I saw the same ill-favoured smile upon his face again, and saw how he watched me. "You're not going, Papa," said Agnes anxiously. "Will you not walk back with Trotwood and me?" He would have looked to Uriah, I believe, before replying, if that worthy had not anticipated him. "I am bespoke myself," said Uriah, "on business. Otherwise I should have been happy to have kept with my friends. But I'll leave my partner to represent the firm. Miss Agnes, ever yours. I wish you good day, Master Copperfield, and leave my humble respects for Miss Betsy Trotwood." With those words he retired, kissing his great hand and leering at us like a mask. We sat there talking about our pleasant old Canterbury days, an hour or two. Mr. Wickfield, left to Agnes, soon became more like his former self, though there was a settled depression upon him which he never shook off. For all that, he brightened, and had an evident pleasure in hearing us recall the little incidents of our old life, many of which he remembered very well. He said it was like those times to be alone with Agnes and me again, and he wished to heaven they'd never changed. I'm sure there was an influence in the placid face of Agnes, and in the very touch of her hand upon his arm, that did wonders for him. My aunt, who was busy nearly all this while with Peggotty in the inner room, wouldn't accompany us to the place where they were staying, but insisted on my going, and I went. We dined together. After dinner, Agnes sat beside him as of old and poured out his wine. He took what she gave him and no more, like a child. And we all three sat together at a window as the evening gathered in. When it was almost dark, he lay down on a sofa, Agnes pillowing his head and bending over him a little while. And when she came back to the window, it was not so dark, but I could see tears glittering in her eyes. I pray heaven that I never may forget the dear girl in her love and truth at that time of my life. For if I should, I must be drawing near the end, and then I would desire to remember her best. She filled my heart with such good resolutions, strengthened my weakness so by her example, so directed, I know not how, she was too modest and gentle to advise me in many words, the wandering ardour and unsettled purpose within me, that all the little good I've done and all the harm I have forborne, I solemnly believe I may refer to her. And how she spoke to me of Dora, sitting at the window in the dark, listened to my praises of her, praised again, and round the little fairy figure shed some glimpses of her own pure light that made it yet more precious and more innocent to me. Oh, Agnes, sister of my boyhood, if I had known then what I knew long afterwards. There was a beggar in the street when I went down, and as I turned my head towards the window, thinking of her calm, seraphic eyes, he made me start by muttering, as if he were an echo of the morning, "Blind, blind, blind." Chapter 36. Enthusiasm. I began the next day with another dive into the Roman bath, and then started for Highgate. I was not dispirited now. I wasn't afraid of the shabby coat and had no yearnings after gallant greys. My whole manner of thinking of our late misfortune was changed. What I had to do was to show my aunt that her past goodness to me had not been thrown away on an insensible, ungrateful object. What I had to do was to turn the painful discipline of my younger days to account by going to work with a resolute and steady heart. What I had to do was to take my woodman's axe in my hand and clear my own way through the forest of difficulty by cutting down the trees until I came to Dora. And I went on at a mighty rate, as if it could be done by walking. When I found myself on the familiar Highgate Road, pursuing such a different errand from that old one of pleasure with which it was associated, it seemed as if a complete change had come on my whole life. But that didn't discourage me. With the new life came new purpose, new intention. Great was the labour, priceless the reward. Dora was the reward, and Dora must be won. I got into such a transport that I felt quite sorry my coat wasn't a little shabby already. I wanted to be cutting at those trees in the forest of difficulty, under circumstances that should prove my strength. I had a good mind to ask an old man in wire spectacles who was breaking stones upon the road to lend me his hammer for a little while and let me begin to beat a path to Dora out of granite. I stimulated myself into such a heat and got so out of breath that I felt as if I had been earning I don't know how much. In this state, I went into a cottage that I saw was to let and examined it narrowly, for I felt it necessary to be practical. It would do for me and Dora admirably. With a little front garden for Jip to run about in and bark at the tradespeople through the railings, and a capital room upstairs for my aunt, I came out again hotter and faster than ever, and dashed up to Highgate at such a rate that I was there an hour too early. And though I hadn't been, should have been obliged to stroll about to cool myself before I was at all presentable. My first care, after putting myself under this necessary course of preparation, was to find the doctor's house. It was not in that part of Highgate where Mrs. Steerforth lived, but quite on the opposite side of the little town. When I made this discovery, I went back in an attraction I couldn't resist, to a lane by Mrs. Steerforth's, and looked over the corner of the garden wall. His room was shut up close. The conservatory doors were standing open, and Rosa Dartle was walking bareheaded with a quick, impetuous step up and down a gravel walk on one side of the lawn. She gave me the idea of some fierce thing that was dragging the length of its chain to and fro upon a beaten track and wearing its heart out. I came softly away from my place of observation, and avoiding that part of the neighbourhood and wishing I'd not gone near it, strolled about until it was 10 o'clock. The church with the slender spire that stands on the top of the hill now wasn't there then to tell me the time. An old red brick mansion used as a school was in its place, and a fine old house it must have been to go to school at, as I recollected. When I approached the doctor's cottage, a pretty old place on which he seemed to have expended some money, if I might judge from the embellishments and repairs that had the look of being just completed, I saw him walking in the garden at the side, gaiters and all, as if he'd never left off walking since the days of my pupilage. He had his old companions about him, too, for there were plenty of high trees in the neighbourhood, and two or three rooks were on the grass looking after him, as if they'd been written to about him by the Canterbury rooks, and were observing him closely in consequence. Knowing the utter hopelessness of attracting his attention from that distance, I made bold to open the gate and walk after him, so as to meet him when he should turn round. When he did, and came towards me, he looked at me thoughtfully for a few moments, evidently without thinking about me at all, and then his benevolent face expressed extraordinary pleasure, and he took me by both hands. "Why, my dear Copperfield," said the doctor, "you are a man. How do you do? I'm delighted to see you. My dear Copperfield, how very much you've improved. You're quite... Yes, dear me." I hoped he was well, and Mrs. Strong, too. "Oh, dear, yes," said the doctor. "Annie's quite well, and she'll be delighted to see you. You were always her favourite. She said so last night when I showed her your letter. And, yes, to be sure, you recollect Mr. Jack Walden, Copperfield?"
"Perfectly, sir."
"Of course," said the doctor. "To be sure, he's pretty well, too." "Has he come home, sir?" I inquired.
"From India," said the doctor.
"Yes. Mr. Jack Maldon couldn't bear the climate, my dear. Mrs. Markleham..." "You've not forgotten Mrs. Markleham?" "Forgotten the old soldier, and in that short time..." "Mrs. Markleham," said the doctor, "was quite vexed about him, poor thing. So we've got him at home again, and we've bought him a little patent place which agrees with him much better." I knew enough of Mr. Jack Maldon to suspect from this account that it was a place where there wasn't much to do, and which was pretty well paid. The doctor, walking up and down with his hand on my shoulder and his kind face turned encouragingly to mine, went on, "Now, my dear Copperfield, in reference to this proposal of yours, it's very gratifying and agreeable to me, I'm sure, but don't you think you could do better? You achieved distinction, you know, when you were with us. You're qualified for many good things. You've laid a foundation that any edifice may be raised upon. And is it not a pity that you should devote the springtime of your life to such a poor pursuit as I can offer?" I became very glowing again, and, expressing myself in a rhapsodical style, I'm afraid, urged my request strongly, reminding the doctor that I had already a profession. "Well, well," returned the doctor, "that's true. Certainly your having a profession, and being actually engaged in studying it, makes a difference. But, my good young friend, what's £70 a year?"
"It doubles our income, Dr. Strong," said I.
"Dear me," replied the doctor, "to think of that. Not that I mean to say it's rigidly limited to £70 a year, because I've always contemplated making any young friend I might thus employ a present, too." "Undoubtedly," said the doctor, still walking me up and down with his hand on my shoulder, "I have always taken an annual present into account."
"My dear tutor," said I, now really without any nonsense, "to whom I owe more obligations already than I ever can acknowledge..."
"No, no," interposed the doctor, "pardon me.
If you will take such time as I have, and that is my mornings and evenings, and can think it worth £70 a year, you will do me such a service as I cannot express."
"Dear me," said the doctor innocently, "to think that so little should go for so much. Dear, dear. And when you can do better, you will."
"On your word now," said the doctor, which he had always made a very grave appeal to the honour of us boys.
"On my word, sir," I returned, answering in our old school manner. "Then be it so," said the doctor, clapping me on the shoulder and still keeping his hand there as we still walked up and down.
"And I shall be 20 times happier, sir," said I, with a little, I hope innocent, flattery, "if my employment is to be on the dictionary."
The doctor stopped, smilingly clapped me on the shoulder again, and exclaimed, with a triumph most delightful to behold, as if I had penetrated to the profoundest depths of mortal sagacity, "My dear young friend, you have hit it. It is the dictionary." How could it be anything else? His pockets were as full of it as his head. It was sticking out of him in all directions. He told me that since his retirement from scholastic life he had been advancing with it wonderfully, and that nothing could suit him better than the proposed arrangements for morning and evening work, as it was his custom to walk about in the daytime with his considering cap on. His papers were in a little confusion, in consequence of Mr. Jack Maldon having lately proffered his occasional services as an amanuensis, and not being accustomed to that occupation. But we should soon put right what was amiss and go on swimmingly. Afterwards, when we were fairly at our work, I found Mr. Jack Maldon's efforts more troublesome to me than I'd expected, as he'd not confined himself to making numerous mistakes, but had sketched so many soldiers' and ladies' heads over the doctor's manuscript that I often became involved in labyrinths of obscurity. The doctor was quite happy in the prospect of our going to work together on that wonderful performance, and we settled to begin next morning at 7 o'clock. We were to work 2 hours every morning, and 2 or 3 hours every night except on Saturdays, when I was to rest. On Sundays, of course, I was to rest also, and I consider these very easy terms. Our plans being thus arranged to our mutual satisfaction, the doctor took me into the house to present me to Mrs. Strong, whom he found in the doctor's new study dusting his books, a freedom which he never permitted anybody else to take with those sacred favourites. They'd postponed their breakfast on my account, and we sat down to table together. We'd not been seated long when I saw an approaching arrival in Mrs. Strong's face before I heard any sound of it. A gentleman on horseback came to the gate, and leading his horse into the little court with the bridle over his arm, as if he were quite at home, tied him to a ring in the empty coach-house wall, and came into the breakfast parlour whip in hand. It was Mr. Jack Maldon. And Mr. Jack Maldon was not at all improved by India, I thought. I was in a state of ferocious virtue, however, as to young men who were not cutting down the trees in the forest of difficulty, and my impression must be received with due allowance. "Mr. Jack," said the doctor, "Copperfield!" Mr. Jack Maldon shook hands with me, but not very warmly, I believed, and with an air of languid patronage at which I secretly took great umbrage. But his languor altogether was quite a wonderful sight, except when he addressed himself to his cousin Annie. "Have you breakfasted this morning, Mr. Jack?" said the doctor. "I hardly ever take breakfast, sir," he replied, with his head thrown back in an easy chair. "I find it bores me." "Is there any news today?" inquired the doctor. "Nothing at all, sir," replied Mr. Maldon. "There's an account about the people being hungry and discontented down in the north, but they're always being hungry and discontented somewhere." The doctor looked grave and said, as though he wished to change the subject, "Then there's no news at all, and no news, they say, is good news." "There's a long statement in the papers, sir, about a murder," observed Mr. Maldon, "but somebody's always being murdered, and I didn't read it." A display of indifference to all the action and passions of mankind was not supposed to be such a distinguished quality at that time, I think, as I have observed it to be considered since. I have known it very fashionable indeed. I've seen it displayed with such success that I've encountered some fine ladies and gentlemen who might as well have been born caterpillars. Perhaps it impressed me the more then because it was new to me, but it certainly didn't tend to exalt my opinion of, or to strengthen my confidence in, Mr. Jack Maldon. I came out to inquire whether Annie would like to go to the opera tonight," said Mr. Maldon, turning to her. "It's the last good night there'll be this season, and there's a singer there whom she really ought to hear. She's perfectly exquisite. Besides which, she's so charmingly ugly," relapsing into languor. The doctor, ever pleased with what was likely to please his young wife, turned to her and said, "You must go, Annie, you must go." "I'd rather not," she said to the doctor. "I prefer to remain at home. I would much rather remain at home." Without looking at her cousin, she then addressed me and asked me about Agnes and whether she should see her, and whether she was not likely to come that day, and was so much disturbed that I wondered how even the doctor, buttering his toast, could be blind to what was so obvious. But he saw nothing. He told her good-naturedly that she was young and ought to be amused and entertained, and must not allow herself to be made dull by a dull old fellow. Moreover, he said he wanted to hear her sing all the new singer's songs to him, and how could she do that well unless she went? So the doctor persisted in making the engagement for her, and Mr. Jack Maldon was to come back to dinner. This concluded, he went to his patent place, I suppose. but at all events went away on his horse, looking very idle. I was curious to find out next morning whether she'd been. She had not, but had sent into London to put her cousin off, and had gone out in the afternoon to see Agnes, and had prevailed upon the doctor to go with her, and they had walked home by the fields, the doctor told me, the evening being delightful. I wondered then whether she would have gone if Agnes had not been in town, and whether Agnes had some good influence over her, too. She didn't look very happy, I thought. But it was a good face, or a very false one. I often glanced at it, for she sat in the window all the time we were at work, and made our breakfast, which we took by snatches as we were employed. When I left at 9 o'clock, she was kneeling on the ground at the doctor's feet, putting on his shoes and gaiters for him. There was a softened shade upon her face, thrown from some green leaves overhanging the open window of the low room. And I thought all the way to Doctor's Commons of the night when I had seen it looking at him as he read. I was pretty busy now, up at 5 in the morning and home at 9 or 10 at night, but I had infinite satisfaction in being so closely engaged and never walked slowly on any account, and felt enthusiastically that the more I tired myself, the more I was doing to deserve Dora. I had not revealed my intensified character to Dora yet, because she was coming to see Miss Mills in a few days, and I deferred all I had to tell her until then, merely informing her in my letters, all our communications were secretly forwarded through Miss Mills, that I had much to tell her. In the meantime, I put myself on a short allowance of bear's grease, wholly abandoned scented soap and lavender water, and sold off 3 waistcoats at a prodigious sacrifice as being too luxurious for my stern career. Not satisfied with all these proceedings, but burning with impatience to do something more, I went to see Traddles, now lodging up behind the parapet of a house in Castle Street, Holborn. Mr. Dick, who had been with me to Highgate 2 times already, and had resumed his companionship with the doctor, I took with me. I took Mr. Dick with me because, acutely sensitive to my aunt's reverses, and sincerely believing that no galley slave or convict worked as I did, he had begun to fret and worry himself out of spirits and appetite as having nothing useful to do. In this condition he felt more incapable of finishing the memorial than ever, and the harder he worked at it, the oftener that unlucky head of King Charles I got into it. Seriously apprehending that his malady would increase unless we put some innocent deception upon him and caused him to believe that he was useful, or unless we could put him in the way of being really useful, which would be better, I made up my mind to try if Traddles could help us. Before we went, I wrote Traddles a full statement of all that had happened, and Traddles wrote me back a capital answer, expressive of his sympathy and friendship. We found him hard at work with his inkstand and papers, refreshed by the sight of the flower-pot stand and the little round table in a corner of the small apartment. He received us cordially, and made friends with Mr. Dick in a moment. Mr. Dick professed an absolute certainty of having seen him before, and we both said, very likely.
This ends side 1 of cassette 17. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
The first subject on which I had to consult Traddles was this. I had heard that many men distinguished in various pursuits had begun life by reporting the debates in Parliament. Traddles having mentioned newspapers to me as one of his hopes, I had put the 2 things together, and told Traddles in my letter that I wished to know how I could qualify myself for this pursuit. Traddles now informed me, as the result of his inquiries, that the mere mechanical acquisition necessary, except in rare cases, for thorough excellence in it, that's to say, a perfect and entire command of the mystery of shorthand writing and reading, was about equal in difficulty to the mastery of 6 languages. And that it might perhaps be attained by dint of perseverance in the course of a few years. Traddles reasonably supposed that this would settle the business, but I, only feeling that here indeed were a few tall trees to be hewn down, immediately resolved to work my way on to Dora through this thicket, axe in hand. "I'm very much obliged to you, my dear Traddles," said I. "I'll begin tomorrow." Traddles looked astonished, as he well might, but he had no notion as yet of my rapturous condition. "I'll buy a book," said I, "with a good scheme of this art in it. I'll work at it at the Commons, where I haven't half enough to do. I'll take down the speeches in our court for practice. Traddles, my dear fellow, I'll master it." "Dear me," said Traddles, opening his eyes, "I had no idea you were such a determined character, Copperfield." I don't know how he should have had, for it was new enough to me. I passed that off and brought Mr. Dick on the carpet. "You see," said Mr. Dick wistfully, "if I could exert myself, Mr. Traddles, if I could beat a drum or blow anything..." "Poor fellow. I have little doubt he would have preferred such an employment in his heart to all others." Traddles, who would not have smiled for the world, replied composedly, "But you're a very good penman, sir. You told me so, Copperfield." "Excellent," said I. And indeed he was. He wrote with extraordinary neatness. "Don't you think," said Traddles, "you could copy writing, sir, if I got them for you?" Mr. Dick looked doubtfully at me. "Eh, Trotwood?" I shook my head. Mr. Dick shook his and sighed. "Tell him about the memorial," said Mr. Dick. I explained to Traddles that there was a difficulty in keeping King Charles the First out of Mr. Dick's manuscript. Mr. Dick, in the meanwhile, looking very deferentially and seriously at Traddles and sucking his thumb. "But these writings, you know, that I speak of, are already drawn up and finished," said Traddles, after a little consideration. "Mr. Dick has nothing to do with them. Wouldn't that make a difference, Copperfield? At all events, wouldn't it be well to try?" This gave us new hope. Traddles and I, laying our heads together apart, while Mr. Dick anxiously watched us from his chair, we concocted a scheme in virtue of which we got him to work next day with triumphant success. On a table by the window in Buckingham Street, we set out the work Traddles procured for him, which was to make, I forget how many copies, of a legal document about some right of way, and on another table we spread the last unfinished original of the great memorial. Our instructions to Mr. Dick were that he should copy exactly what he had before him, without the least departure from the original, and that when he felt it necessary to make the slightest allusion to King Charles the First, he should fly to the memorial. We exhorted him to be resolute in this, and left my aunt to observe him. My aunt reported to us afterwards that, at first, he was like a man playing the kettle drums, and constantly divided his attentions between the two, but that finding this confuse and fatigue him, and having his copy there plainly before his eyes, he soon sat at it in an orderly, business-like manner, and postponed the memorial to a more convenient time. In a word, although we took great care that he should have no more to do than was good for him, and although he didn't begin with the beginning of a week, he earned by the following Saturday night 10 shillings and 9 pence. And never while I live shall I forget his going about to all the shops in the neighbourhood to change this treasure into sixpences, or his bringing them to my aunt, arranged in the form of a heart upon a waiter, with tears of joy and pride in his eyes. He was like one under the propitious influence of a charm from the moment of his being usefully employed. And if there were a happy man in the world that Saturday night, it was the grateful creature who thought my aunt the most wonderful woman in existence, and me the most wonderful young man. "No starving now, Trotwood," said Mr. Dick, shaking hands with me in a corner. "I'll provide for her, sir." And he flourished his 10 fingers in the air, as if they were 10 banks. I hardly know which was the better pleased, Traddles or I. "It really," said Traddles, suddenly taking a letter out of his pocket and giving it to me, "put Mr. Micawber quite out of my head." The letter, Mr. Micawber never missed any possible opportunity of writing a letter, was addressed to me by the kindness of T. Travels, Esquire of the Inner Temple. It ran thus. My dear Copperfield, you may possibly not be unprepared to receive the intimation that something has turned up. I may have mentioned to you on a former occasion that I was in expectation of such an event. I am about to establish myself in one of the provincial towns of our favoured island, where the society may be described as a happy admixture of the agricultural and the clerical, in immediate connection with one of the learned professions. Mrs. Micawber and our offspring will accompany me. Our ashes, at a future period, will probably be found commingled in the cemetery attached to a venerable pile, for which the spot to which I refer has acquired a reputation, shall I say, from China to Peru. In bidding adieu to the modern Babylon, where we have undergone many vicissitudes, I trust not ignobly, Mrs. Micawber and myself cannot disguise from our minds that we part, it may be for years and it may be for ever, with an individual linked by strong associations to the altar of our domestic life. If, on the eve of such a departure, you will accompany our mutual friend Mr. Thomas Traddles to our present abode, and there reciprocate the wishes natural to the occasion, you will confer a boon on one who is ever yours, Wilkins Micawber. I was glad to find that Mr. Micawber had got rid of his dust and ashes, and that something really had turned up at last. Learning from Traddles that the invitation referred to the evening then wearing away, I expressed my readiness to do honour to it, and we went off together to the lodging which Mr. Micawber occupied as Mr. Mortimer, and which was situated near the top of the Gray's Inn Road. The resources of this lodging were so limited that we found the twins, now some 8 or 9 years old, reposing in a turn-up bedstead in the family sitting-room, where Mr. Micawber had prepared, in a wash-handstand jug, what he called a brew of the agreeable beverage for which he was famous. I had the pleasure on this occasion of renewing the acquaintance of Master Micawber, whom I found a promising boy of about 12 or 13, very subject to that restlessness of limb which is not an infrequent phenomenon in youths of his age. I also became once more known to his sister, Miss Micawber, in whom, as Mr. Micawber told us, her mother renewed her youth like the phoenix. "My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, "yourself and Mr. Traddles find us on the brink of migration, and will excuse any little discomforts incidental to that position." Glancing round as I made a suitable reply, I observed that the family effects were already packed, and that the amount of luggage was by no means overwhelming. I congratulated Mrs. Micawber on the approaching change. "My dear Mr. Copperfield," said Mrs. Micawber, "of your friendly interest in all our affairs, I am well assured. My family may consider it banishment if they please, but I am a wife and mother, and I never will desert Mr. Micawber." Traddles, appealed to by Mrs. Micawber's eye, feelingly acquiesced. "That," said Mrs. Micawber, "that at least is my view, my dear Mr. Copperfield and Mr. Traddles, of the obligation which I took upon myself when I repeated the irrevocable words, 'I, Emma, take thee, Wilkins.' I read the service over with a flat candle on the previous night, and the conclusion I derived from it was that I never could desert Mr. Micawber. And," said Mrs. Micawber, "though it is possible I may be mistaken in my view of the ceremony, I never will." "My dear," said Mr. Micawber a little impatiently, "I am not conscious that you're expected to do anything of the sort." "I am aware, my dear Mr. Copperfield," pursued Mrs. Micawber, "that I am now about to cast my lot among strangers, and I'm also aware that the various members of my family, to whom Mr. Micawber has written in the most gentlemanly terms, announcing that fact, have not taken the least notice of Mr. McCormick's communication. Indeed, I may be superstitious, said Mrs. Micawber, but it appears to me that Mr. Micawber is destined never to receive any answers whatever to the great majority of the communications.